We're all looking to make more sustainable choices, but making your own shoes out of natural materials could pose a few challenges. The twigs and leaves in your yard aren't exactly comfortable, and while mud does perfectly contour the feet, it doesn't score high on the durability front. But thanks to Allbirds, you can skip all the backyard experimentation. At the Allbirds Innovation Lab, they're doing all the sciencey stuff like research and testing to create shoes from natural, sustainable materials. And their innovative processes mean using less of the bad stuff and more of the good, while making shoes unlike any other. Like the Plant Pacer, made with 100% plastic-free plant leather. The Tree Dasher, a running shoe made from eucalyptus tree fiber. And from Sugarcane, they've made the Superlight, their lightest shoe ever by weight and carbon footprint. It's not rocket science, it's shoe science. Allbirds is making shoes better than natural. They're supernatural. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com today. That's Allbirds.com.
One screen. People are like, yes, this answers all the questions I never knew I had.
Right.
And that doesn't exist for like a spatial computing device yet. It's like.
Welcome to Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast, your place for resources and in-depth conversations with other game development professionals. I'm your host, John J.P. Podlasic. I've worked at 10 different game companies, starting back in 1989 with the TurboGrafx-16. Over the decades, I've developed games like Mortal Kombat, Avengers Initiative, Beavis and Butthead, and numerous others. I now work for a startup called Level X. But this podcast isn't about me. It's about you and the game development community. So if you have questions or ideas, give a call, 224-484-7733, or go to the GameDevAdvice.com website. So let's kick things off with the new Game Dev Advice.
Hey, everybody. I've got Turk here today, a designer, and he's going to talk about his current role and all kinds of things. How's it going, Turk?
Hi, John. Thank you for having me on today. It's a pleasure, man. I love your podcast.
Wow. Cool. That's great to hear. So we've known each other a while, but just why don't you tell me what your current role is right now?
Yeah. So I'm at Phosphor Games. I'm a lead designer over there. Kind of rose through the ranks, started out as a technical designer, did a lot of kind of design scripting type of stuff, just being a problem solver. I think somebody on one of your previous podcasts mentioned that, you know, that the industry is always looking for problem solvers. And that's very true. You know, if you can be useful and be there to help, artists do something or create some cool content with tools that programmers provide, I mean, you're a problem solver and you can get a lot of stuff done.
Yeah. And those type of people are always in demand, right? The ones that can just solve problems and ship games and figure things out. So, so tell me how you got started in this business.
So I started playing games when I first came here. So I'm an immigrant, right? I came here in like 1990 when I was 7 years old.
Okay.
And I got an NES, a Nintendo Entertainment System, and I fell in love with it, right? Playing Super Mario Brothers, falling into every pit, cursing, getting in trouble for cursing, just having a great time. And I was like, this is awesome. And like playing, you know, great games, terrible games, playing something like, you know, the Rambo NES game or, DuckTales or Mario Brothers or Jaws. Man, Jaws was not a great game, but I played a lot of it.
Right.
Yeah. So just fell in love with it. And then growing up, it's like, I fell in love with games. I fell in love with comic books and I fell in love with animation. And when it was time to kind of pick a school, I'm like, okay, I really love this stuff. Like, is there any way that I can kind of make that a career or, you know, get a job in any of this stuff?
Right.
So there was a school here in Chicago, the American Academy of Art. And, you know, like Alex Ross went there, this famous comic book artist.
Yeah.
And then also like some Midway guys went there, right? I think John Tobias and just a lot of people went there. So I'm like, you know, this school.
Vogel. Yeah.
Yeah, it has people that like make cool stuff like here in Chicago. I'll give it a shot. So I went there, did a 3D modeling and video course and, you know, just kind of learned to work with other people and learned to experiment and failed a lot, you know, just like creatively, right? Not grades. Grades you're going to pass kind of no matter what, but but just creatively, like I would fail and I'd be like, why did I mess that up? And I would look at other students' work and I would be like, oh, I see why I failed or like I can do it right next time. And so by the time that I finished that, I was actually pretty good at Photoshop. I was good at the like Adobe video programs. I was good at Flash, but I had no confidence. I was like, I can't do anything. Sure, I mm-hmm. could use all these programs, but I'm not good at anything. Mm-hmm. And I was also near the end of that. That was like 2005. I was volunteering the Chicago IGDA, which right. You know, in 05, 06, it was huge, right? Because you had EA Chicago, you had Midway. It was a big thing. They were stealing talent from one another. It was just like a really cool time in the industry here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And the person that ran it at the time was the HR person at Midway. And she was like, hey, I have a couple of leads. Like, we have this QA position up and this UI position. Mm-hmm. And I had no confidence in my abilities whatsoever. So I'm like, you know, QA sounds like a great place to learn everything about video games. And I managed to, you know, interview, did well enough on that they, you know, extended me an offer. Mm-hmm. And it was August of 2005 was like my first month of doing QA in the game industry.
Wow. That's great. So yeah, you're coming up on your 15-year anniversary this
Yeah, August. It's scary.
Yeah.
So my first week there or first couple days there, I was there for the European submission of MK Shaolin Monks.
Okay.
Which was a fantastic game, right? Like co-op, yeah. Mm-hmm. Beat 'em up in the MK1, MK2 style. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea what I was doing, right? They're just like, play. And I'm like, okay, I'll play. And there's guys there that could beat the game in, you know, like a few hours, a couple hours. And I'm just like stumbling around. And I found a bug where if you died too much, or like if you died in certain parts of the game, mm-hmm. like that actually broke progression. That like the guys were so good in QA that somebody that just came on and like just died and continued a lot broke the mm-hmm. game because of something that like wasn't caught because the guys were so good at playing it.
With fresh eyes and stuff. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But oh my God, man, those first couple of days, I think it was the most hours I've ever put in. I think there was like a 20-hour day at one point on one of those submissions where it was just, you know, cause I'm new, this is like my first gig. I'm going to give it my all. Mm-hmm. So yeah, just a lot of father and son, you know, food and just helping get the thing out the door. Even to this day, I remember how to say test your might in Spanish. So
for those people listening, Father and Sons is it's a small local Italian restaurant that would do carry out. And during back in the day when you would crunch, you'd be ordering food from there a lot. So you said you had immigrated. I was just curious about that. Where did you come from?
Yeah. My parents were both born in Poland.
Ah, okay. Cool.
And so, you know, around the fall of the Soviet Union era, right, like the early 90s, mm-hmm. they just came here. They were able to bring me here.
Wow.
And growing up, everyone's like, oh, you're Polish? Like, you don't have an accent or anything. It's like, yeah, because I tried really hard as a kid to just, you know, assimilate as much as possible.
You know, I hear from people all over the world that listen to the show. So I think it's always kind of cool for people to hear that at different countries. And so now that you're closing in on your 15-year anniversaries, what do you wish you had known when you started in the industry?
I think the biggest thing, and I alluded to this a little bit earlier, was just having confidence, just knowing what I can do. Right. Like one of the biggest reasons why I didn't try like for that initial UI position was because I didn't think I was good. But like looking back, if today's Turk was looking back at, you know, 15 years ago, Turk, mm-hmm. it'd be like, you can do this. Like you probably have enough skill or, you know, to learn or to do this or to for like an entry level position, like you could do this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't even take the chance for it.
Yeah. I mean, you had the Photoshop and Adobe Creative Suite. So you had a lot of those things needed on the UI side. So, yeah.
And that was one of the greatest things at Midway over there with do you remember the wiki that Midway had?
Yeah. 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 Martin Murphy kind of drove some of that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody like me who was just in QA, you know, in my spare time, I could see what the different teams were doing in terms of tech and art and design. So mm-hmm. I could look up design docs. I could see, you know, art specifications, learning about, you know, how some upcoming projects were going to use normal maps or something. Mm-hmm. And that was huge. That would, you know, that actually got me to understand like what a designer does, what a programmer does, what an artist does. Mm-hmm. And that year in QA just really helped direct me and, you know, make me feel like build that confidence of like, I could do this. I could do an environment or I could do a level.
It's cool to see that it was used that way and that it helped you get some footing and understanding the industry, you know, while you were there. So, oh, that's great.
Yeah, no, I loved it, man. We had so many talented like developers at Midway. They, you know, looking at what like the you know, the never released, like Shadow, was a Fire and Ice MK game was going to possibly look like, or, you know, what the Seattle studio was doing with visual effects, or, you know, the Austin studios were doing with their games. There was some like magical stuff going on that never got to see the light of day. You really have to make stuff, right? Whether it's, if it's a popular game that you like and it has some ability to mod it, do that, right? Create some mods. Even if maybe like two people are playing, just do it. You know, if it's kind of like a bigger scale thing that you have in your head, maybe you're learning Unity or Unreal, release something, right? Like myself, you know, I have a lot of experience, so, you know, it's kind of not fair for me to say this, but, you know, I released a small, iPhone game and, small, you know, yeah, like a mobile game, just work on content, just make stuff, learn how it works. You know, when we're, I know, like personally, when I'm looking for a designer, usually if they have examples of things they've made, whether it's student games, whether it's their own kind of personal projects, like the scope doesn't have to be huge, right? Like no one is looking for, you know, somebody to have made a Grand Theft Auto or a Call of Duty. But if you made some really even small, like 5-minute, you know, narrative game, or some kind of a simple puzzle, or just even a mechanic that's kind of captivating, that can go a long way. And that shows people that you can complete something, right? It's like one of the reasons you know, I got into QA was like, I had a BFA, I completed something, right?
Yeah.
But like with a project like that, it's like, if you can show somebody like a finished piece, you know, for art, usually it's like, oh, it's nicely lit and it's rendered. But for a game designer, it's more, do you have something that I can interact with that kind of has, even if it's a vignette, something that's kind of like a complete little pack.
Yeah. And then it's something in the interview process someone could try out, or they could try out before the interview, and then you can speak to, you know, why you made those decisions for the controls and how the jump works and how that sliding mechanism works or whatever it is. Right. But,
exactly.
Yeah. And, well, the thing too, is that it, you know, when you started, and even way back when I started, there wasn't game engines that were readily available that you could just download for free. Right. So, and you can get student versions of Maya, and, you know, you can get Photoshop $10 a month or something. So the tools are there. Right. And that's the advantage that people have starting nowadays, is they're out there. You just have to put the controller down and not play games all the time, but actually then also make games and actually try stuff and learn tools and get passionate about that and actually make stuff and not just say, well, I got a resume, now I want a job. It's like, no, you have to show that you can make content and be able to show that and be able to speak to using the tools.
Yeah. And, you know, it's going beyond like the cookie cutter stuff that a lot of schools do, right? Cause that's good. If you can follow a assignment really well, that's awesome.
Right.
But what I'm more interested in, what did you do with what you learned? Did you take that and then make your own thing, make your own take on it? You know, did you like take that to the next level? Cause you know, so there's some companies that will give you a really simple test, right? It's like do a very basic shooter or something, or like a match 3 game. And then if they just give you like, oh, here's a really basic match 3 game. And you're like, okay, cool, match 3 game. But if, you know, you play it and then it's like, there's some weird RPG elements or there's crazy particles or whatever their kind of unique skill set that they bring to the table, they've kind of just shown it off. That's awesome. And you know, if I'm talking to them and they can, you can hear the passion, if you can feel them, you know, explaining to you why they took those steps and you can't get them to shut up about it, that's fantastic. Like,
right.
You know, having people just be so into it where they're just, they can't
absorb by it. Yeah, they can't
help themselves, right? They just want to talk about it. They want to keep working. They're working on it in their head as they're talking to you, right? They're fixing the bugs in their head as they're describing it.
Yeah, no. And that's great. It's just that passion and that wanting to keep, you know, not just doing the minimum or not just doing the basic thing, but then taking it to that next step and then using those lessons learned and figuring out how to give it their own twist. Or, you know, I brought this up in a podcast way back ago when we were interviewing artists, and you know, everyone was looking at everyone's reels and everyone had the same exact things because everyone did the same exact thing, build a clock and do this, and everyone's portfolios look the same. And it's like, well, what the hell is the difference between you or anyone else, right? So, and then there's when people do something else that's different and cool and higher quality, because after they had those building blocks, they learned how to do the things, they then took it to the next stage. You know, that stands out. And, you know, the competition is fierce out there now. So you really have to be able to stand out. You really have to be able to show what you've done that's unique and speaks to whatever discipline you're going into. And it's not just, here's my resume and here's this group project I did and leaving it at that. And along those lines, as a designer with all this experience you have now, like what kind of, career advice do you have for the game designers like yourself at a, mid or senior level in their careers right now?
Oh man, that's a good question. I would say just keep challenging yourself. It can be easy to just take it day by day, not really just to kind of float, not really push yourself, not really try new things. It's easy to fall into a hole, but, play new games, play games that are, different, or, maybe game it, like Fortnite. Like how many people will be like, oh, Fortnite, I don't want to touch that. It's a stupid game. It's so popular. But it's like, no, it's a fantastic game. It's this generation's Mario Brothers, right? It's
right.
Amazing.
Yeah. There's a reason it's so popular, right?
Yeah. Or, even making stuff, right? Like what's this, PBR stuff people are talking about? Well, physically based rendering, ray tracing, those are big things. Like it might not specifically apply to a designer, but it helps if, some artist approaches you who is fantastic, has that passion, can make these beautiful environments or set pieces or characters that are well lit. And if you can be like, I know exactly how we can use that in our design, in our level design, or in our, systems design, or whatever it happens to be, like, that's amazing. I look at a game like even the new Mortal Kombat, right? They do fantastic character animations, character skin, the blood, right? All the stuff that's hot today in terms of rendering, in terms of, like the network stuff, the different rankings and network ladder climbs that they have, it complements the stuff that's breaking new ground, that's going somewhere. You just kind of have to keep challenging yourself, and it's scary. I mean, the first time I touched Unreal Engine 4, after coming from like Unreal Engine 3, I felt like a complete moron. I had no idea what I was doing. But then, you make one thing, you make a jump, right? Then you make a platform, and then you start putting that stuff together. Or you're like, oh, that's easy. Yeah, if we need to set that thing on fire, yeah, don't worry about that. We can send an event, do a trace, do a particle. We got this. But it takes a bit of failing, a bit of challenging yourself to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's like, not resting on your laurels. So always being curious, always trying to play new games, see what's going on. And then also, like you said, learning new tools. And again, nowadays with all the tutorials that are out there, there's so many resources for learning how to use the different tools that you can make that leap both from trial and error. And then when you get, really hit a brick wall, then you can look online and find some videos that are teaching some new things on Unreal 4 that you can figure out how to apply that. But I think, being curious and always be wanting to push yourself is important.
The YouTube thing is even great if you knew how to do something and you just kind of remember like three words and you're like, oh, I knew there was a thing somewhere in Unreal.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh yeah, not like bump mapping. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, there it is. That's how you do it. Cool.
Right. So in terms of projects, what's been like your, one or two favorite games or projects to work on over your career?
So my first project as some junior designer, it was John Woo's Stranglehold at Midway. And dude, that was a dream like I got so lucky to get on that project as like one of my first design gigs.
Yeah.
Working with a great team. Like that was awesome. The system that we had, it was kind of like, I guess what would be like pod-based nowadays. You could kind of focus with some artists and some programmers and, work on your content, work on your level. Even like between the designers themselves, there was so much collaboration, right? Like we would get moved from level to level every so often. So like you weren't just an owner of a level from beginning to end. You would see other people's stuff. And when you did that, you could learn new things and, other people could learn from you. So no, it's just a great environment to make cool stuff, and learn.
Lots of explosions. You learn about a lot of particle effects and things and buildings and things, because that was John Woo's.
That was so
for that game.
That was so cool to see that come together, because we had Art Tech in Chicago. It was called, what was it, the Massive D Tech, right? To break stuff.
Yeah.
And then we had the Seattle team doing the effects for it. And when we got those dailies of some of those effects, oh my God, John, they looked so good. It was like, oh my, that fish! Look at that fish tank. That water is like pouring down the side, and the fish are flopping around. That looks so amazing. Or the destructible cars that were a holdover from actual working cars that, it's kind of a secret, but no one talks about it. But you can pop the tires and shatter the windshields and break the mirrors and the level of detail in the game was insane for, you know, for a really fun, just slow-mo shooter.
Yeah. Yeah. It was pretty trend-setting back at the time for all the stuff that it was doing, considering how long ago it was in the scheme of things.
It's funny to interview or bring on designers nowadays that are like, oh, Stranglehold. Oh my, I love that game as a kid. And I'm like, oh man, as a kid, you're killing me.
Right, right. And then there was PsyOps before that, and that was some of the same team. And I actually worked in that for a little bit. And that was, you know, Kinetic Powers and doing some really cool stuff. And that's always been like a sleeper hit fan favorite of people. And I'll put it in the show notes, but PsyOps was published by Midway and had a lot of cool mechanics, a lot of great gameplay.
Yeah, both Havoc physics powered games.
Yeah, Havoc, right, right. I remember being part of getting that contract with Havoc 1.0. Getting that in to be able to license the physics and get all that working in the game. Yeah, they were based out of Ireland, at least they were. So the industry right now, like, what are you curious about? Like, what are you excited and curious about with the way things are going?
You know, it's kind of scary right now. You know, having done my own little, you know, side project for mobile mm-hmm. and seeing it kind of get no exposure for the most part.
Yeah. It's what was the name of that game again?
Oh, sorry. So we had an old game called The Occupant, but we updated it as Sarcoph, S-A-R-C-O-P-H. It's like a scary first person kind of a tap and move, kind of hide and seek game, a little bit of a hidden object thing, but it's first person. It's a little jump scary. Mm-hmm. Myself and my friend, Colin Joyce, we worked on it to kind of cool. The original one and the update for it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, the market right now, it's scary. It's scary in a way where, you know, like you said, everyone kind of can make stuff, right? Unity's a thing, Unreal's a thing, Game Maker is a thing. You know, people and the stores like Steam Store or the App Store, you know, pretty much anyone can release whatever they want as long as they give the storefronts $100.
Right.
And, you know, unless you kind of have an established base, unless you already have, you know, thousands of followers or thousands of wish lists on Steam, it's tough, man. There's nothing really to elevate people with no exposure, which, right. You know, I get, right? That's kind of the natural order of things, but it's something people have to adapt to that, you know, you kind of have to build your audience. You have to build a following before you can kind of release anything now. And it's not just like old marketing, right? I mean, it's not just like throwing some fancy trailer at people and, you know, tricking them into buying your game. But it's like, no, you want to build, you want to be, you know, create some consistent content that gets people coming like to your content and then trusting you to be like, yeah, you know, we took this to the next level. We're making, you know, we took this comic strip and now we're making it a game. And it's like, okay, cool. And there's been, you know, successful people that have done that, right? Like the crazy example would be something like Homestuck, right? Where this comic strip, online comic strip out of nowhere just has legions of fans, you know, and that people that kind of follow it almost religiously. It's pretty crazy. But again, being consistent, having a following, that's, you kind of need that to get anywhere if you're an indie. And even, you know, with the storefronts right now, you know, there's like Apple Arcade, there's like Stadia. But you kind of have to know the right people to get into those, right? It's nice if you can get in there. It can definitely help pay your, like, you know, I've heard other stories on other podcasts of people like, yeah, you know, it's great to be on here and it helps out, but it's a very walled garden. And if you're not in there, you know, you're kind of stuck out in the cold with the rest of the apps.
Yeah. And it's that blessing and curse, right? Because the barrier has gone down. So now there is so much more content out there and it is, how do you rise above? How do you get attention, right? It's not Field of Dreams. It's not just build it and they'll come, right? It's like you have to have momentum behind you. You have to have, you know, like you said, people wanting it on Steam. And then even, you know, on mobile, so tricky now too, because the stakes are getting higher and there's a lot of money in the free-to-play space. So the companies, especially the bigger companies, just throw more and more money at user acquisition. And, you know, so they're buying eyeballs, they're buying players to see who's, you know, then going to convert to be a player, a payer of a player. And, you know, it's a bit of an arms war in some of the games and some of the genres on mobile, just because the user acquisition costs are going through the roof and you have to have deep pockets to compete on a more traditional way without some kind of hook or some kind of audience already there to embrace and be excited about your game.
Yeah. And you know, trying to like figure out what that audience is that will resonate with your game, that's a hard thing in and of itself. Like, you know, I could look back on the you know, my Sarkov game that we did. Is it too scary? Maybe, you know, is the style a little bit like too much for mobile that, you know, games like Five Nights at Freddy's or, you know, Granny can succeed that kind of seem more approachable to younger audiences. Or even, you know, one of the things is like the game that we made, it's portrait mode, right? So I'm like, oh, I want to play with one hand. I want it to be very accessible. But so many of the games right now on mobile are just landscape. They're just traditional kind of, you know, virtual controls. And I think one of the other reasons for that is those games stream well, right? So you have this kind of people on YouTube, right, on Twitch, they want content to show to people. And if your content doesn't show well, they're not going to pick it up. If they don't pick it up, it doesn't get exposed to any eyeballs in an organic way, right? So then buy ads. And like you said, right, if let me get like a few users. Oh, that's going to be a few thousand dollars. It's like, ah, it's okay. I don't have that. I
can't. Right, right. Or it's going to be $10,000 or $100,000 or even more. It's a good point. I didn't really think about that, but to being able to stream a game in portrait mode, then you have all that dead space on the sides and it's not conducive to that. So does that turn off the streamers and kind of make it more of a challenge on online with streaming and stuff? Interesting.
The other thing that I'm really kind of curious about is, you know, this is the year that the new systems come out, right? The new Xbox and PlayStation 5. And there's claims out there, right? They're like, no load times or very little load times, which to me sounds great. Cause you know, I've been in situations where I'll get like a Call of Duty or something. And first it's the, you know, hour install, and then it's the hour of updating patches. And then by the time I get to play it, like I have to, you know, go back to the kids and I can't play it anymore.
Okay, quick question break. What are your thoughts so far? Do you have a topic idea, a question to ask, or a guest suggestion? Let me know at 224-484-7733 or on the gamedevadvice.com website.
Right, right. Yeah, your family's waiting for you. It's like, you've been playing the game for 3 hours. It's like, no, I've been trying to get it started so I can play.
I've been staring at a loading bar. This was the best.
Loading bar. Yeah. And then this 60 gig update and you're like, oh man. it's like the old PC days. Cause it was always, you'd ship it on a disc and then you would never play a game version 1.0. You always wait for the update. And whenever you buy a game on a PC, that was the first thing you do is try and update it because it needed to be done, but that was supposed to be solved by the consoles. But once the consoles went online, cracked the door on that option again. And it's very much like that again.
Yeah. So I'm looking way forward to see if they can live up to that, you know, get you in fast. And even, you know, that being complemented by like something like Xbox's streaming platform, where, you know, if you don't have a system, you can just go on xCloud, I think they call it, or.
Yeah. I'm not 100% sure about that. I've heard about it, but I don't know the details.
So it's interesting, man. The faster I can get into a game, you know, for the little time I have to play, is the better. That's why the only gaming I do right now is like on the Switch, because the downloads are small. I can play really fast. I can, you know, play it on the couch if the family's got the TV, and just you know, get some rounds of Fortnite in, like, you know, dad Fortnite. I'm just, you know, looking at trees and building, like learning how to build stuff and then getting shot by like the first person that sees you.
I'm going to try this fishing thing. Oh man, I got shot.
But you know, it's okay, cause you can find another game in like, you know, a minute. So that's all right.
Right. Yeah. So kind of related to that, what about potential threats do you see to the game industry?
Oh, that's a good question. I worry about that question cause, I can be a little bit of a pragmatic person sometimes. So to me, a lot of stuff looks like threats to the game industry. But, oh man, for that specific question, just right now, it's kind of something that I mentioned before. Right now, I think the biggest thing that I worry about is the amount of content and how unsustainable that is for people making that content, right? There's so many choices. People are making so much stuff. And that's kind of always been the case, right? Like not every shareware game was a huge success, or not every, you know, game on PlayStation or other systems that came out back in the day was a huge success. Mm-hmm. But it's just scary to see people that are good at gaming the system, right? Like on Steam, where it's like, oh, let's see what's trending with people. You know, what fetish can we tickle to
knock off type game?
Yeah, where it's like, oh, okay, you know, is this really advancing any kind of the medium in any way, or is it just that person that is kind of a scammer figuring out how to game the system?
Yeah.
And yeah, just more of that stuff kind of like you even kind of see it on the Switch store where there's all these, you know, 2 cent, 10 cent, 5 cent games where it's just flooding the market. And the kind of old question of, you know, do we need curation? But does curation even make sense in today's market where there, you know, where anybody could release a game and there's so many titles? Yeah, just trying to see. I mean, you know, Apple Arcade right now, that's an awesome thing to see because they're trying to curate stuff, right? They're trying to kind of just pick things. But on the flip side of that, you know, if you're a smaller developer and you don't get into Apple Arcade, it's like, well, what good is it to me? I'm here on the sidelines. I'm not seeing anything cool.
Right, right. Yeah, the walled garden doesn't let me in. Yeah, and I saw something, I read it today in one of the industry newsletters. I think it was like 600 games came out on Xbox in 2019, I think they were saying, and then it was 1400 on Switch alone, right? And then, you know, God knows how many came out on Steam, but it just shows that the number of options out there are just mind-boggling. And it's like, again, how do you make a game stand out? What's unique about it? You know, how's it gonna kind of rise above the noise with all the competition out there?
Yeah, because there's so many talented like game developers out there, right? And if I wish all of them would get a chance to like just be able to sit down and make their game and not worry about finances. But man, we live in the real world, right? It's you got bills to pay. You kind of can't, unless you're in a perfect situation where you have a bunch of money saved up, you know, your cost of living is super low. You kind of can't just, you know, not make a living for 6, 9, 14 months, right? You kind of have to keep the lights on.
Yeah. And yes, some of the companies that, you know, can have huge war chests of money and it can be huge and they could say it'll come out when it's ready and you know, they don't have to worry about those kind of financial constraints. But yeah, those companies are few and far between. So yeah, you have to figure out how to ship, you have to figure out how to make things appealing. You kind of touch on a little bit, but like, what do you see the big opportunities? Like you talk about short loading times, the new consoles, Stadia, like what are you excited about for opportunities in the industry?
Yeah, right now I was in the back of my head, something about you know, machine learning and about like that that idea of creating a system that kind of learns what the player is doing. You know, to me, there's something there, especially with when you mix it into like a game as a service game. I could totally see something cool happening where, you know, the AI NPCs in the game just like learn your play style and find that balance of like.
Yeah.
When people roll out, what do they call them? Like events in a game, right? It's kind of like, here's the event, we planned it out and 70 to 90% of the people will love it, right? But what if they can get to a point where, you know, each kind of user has been learned well enough where the events could be tailored to the individual user without a higher, you know, margin than just one big generic event? Like that could be kind of creepy, but kind of awesome at the same time.
Yeah, a more customized experience that tailors to your playing style and abilities and stuff like that. And that's interesting.
Yeah, it's also interesting to see right now that, you know, both of the big console hardwares coming out, they seem kind of even in terms of power or even their manufacturer, right? They both seem like ATI powered, very high performance machines. So even to see, you know, not having to deal with like, oh no, we have to, you know, make this thing for the lowest common denominator console. It's like, no, you kind of don't. You can make it for, you know, the two most powerful consoles and it could be a really cool game just to see like, what does that offer? What opportunities does that, you know, generate for designers, for artists, for programmers?
Yeah, you're right. It's like an arms war, and there's a lot of parity between the platforms. So it becomes less about the graphics and more about, you know, is your favorite exclusive on this platform versus that platform, or what's the online experience like versus one versus the other. You know, in the olden days, there was very much the when Xbox original launched, they had a very curated kind of organized thought behind online, and with Sony, it was more kind of Wild West, roll your own, just forget how to connect it with GameSpy and do whatever you want. So it was two very different experiences. Although, you know, graphically looking at it, they were fairly similar-ish in some ways, although PS2 is a lot more difficult to program for. But
really fast, like the you know, kind of the biggest thing in the last, I want to say, you know, like 4 or 5 years has been kind of the battle royale game mode. But what is that really, right? What happened was, like, you know, the initial modder, whether it's player unknown or whoever, hey, I want to take 100 players and have it be 100 player deathmatch with no response. But let's do it in this constricting dome. I mean, that's a simple idea. Like when you look back at it in hindsight, right? There was a game at Phosphor called, you know, Nether. Like, hey, if we threw a dome on that thing that shrank, we could have had something similar. But, you know, who puts those things together? It's like you almost need things to cool off, and for these things to have been tried and be ingredients to make a new cake, right? Like just even seeing Epic's take on it with their battle royale, you know, it is different enough that it has evolved the formula, and it's become this battle royale event space where kids are socializing, which is like, okay, weird, cool. This is the AOL chat room of the, you know, 2020.
Right, right. No, that's a good metaphor. So what about thoughts on AR and VR? I know that's something that's near and dear to you. So okay,
I love VR, and I've spent like the last 5 years making VR stuff. John, from the first day that we got like the Vive VR headset, you put that thing on, the head tracking was mind blowing. I mean, just the simplest scene, right? Like you put it on and you look up and there's like a lamppost, and you move your head around a little bit and you're like, holy moly, I'm in this space. Like I feel like that lamppost is really there. So like from that very first kind of demo, it was like, whoa, this thing is groundbreaking, right? So to me, I kind of like to think of that whole space as spatial computing. That's one of the terms I saw thrown around about it, because it is this shift of like, how do you represent data interaction in 3D that you can actually touch in some way, whether it's through a pointer or through motion controls or through fingers, whatever. It's you're dealing with data that's represented in space,
right?
And you know, the projects that I've been working on are like, you know, enterprise stuff where you can you know, we're showing you the city of the future for vehicles, you know, how electric vehicles will change the world, or you know, or let's shoot zombies in the middle of a field. That's also fun, like wave shooter zombie type stuff.
Right.
So, you know, to me, again, that immersion, that presence, that way of displaying information, it is the future. But I even with AR, I don't think we've gotten to a point where, you know, we know how to show it in a way that everybody wants to try it, right? It's still very, very new. It's still very...
It's hobbyist in some ways, right?
Yes.
You have to have hardware, and you have to have the patience to recalibrate things and plug shit back in and see if it'll work this third time. And
yeah, and even, you know, a device like the Quest, like it does a great job of eliminating a lot of that stuff, but it's there's still that, like, you know, you have this headgear on and you're kind of trapped in this world, but, you know, you kind of can see the thing. The stuff like what is it? I think I've heard that the biggest company in AR right now is like Facebook, right? With Instagram. Like Instagram is like the top AR service right now. And it's true, right? Because people just like, they're visualizing something funny, or they're visualizing
put cat ears on their on somebody or something.
Yeah, and you know, the dream, of course, is like, you know, you take out your phone and you have Google Maps or whatever map software, and you see this, like, you know, magic fable path of like, oh, how do I go to McDonald's? And it's like, here's the path to your closest McDonald's. And you're like, oh, cool. Or even, you know, looking around, if you're like, hey, let's find a 5-star restaurant, it's like, oh, let me just, you know, look through my phone screen, and I can see that there's like, you know, Grand Theft Auto style beam coming out from it over there. But is that practical? Does that make any sense? You know, is that any easier than looking at a list or at a map right now? And I think that's the big disconnect, right? If you look at, you know, old IBM computer, the green, phosphor green screen, right?
Yeah.
And then you're like, well, you know, you could do the same thing on this color monitor. It's like, yeah, but it's the same thing, same numbers, we're crunching. You know, until you get to a point where it just makes sense. Like the iPhone, right? When Steve Jobs announced the iPhone, it was like email, internet, music, one screen. People were like, yes, this answers all the questions I never knew I had. Right, and that doesn't exist for like a spatial computing device yet. It's like, you know, there were mobile phones before the iPhone. There were tablets, right? Like the pocket PC stuff before the iPhone.
Yeah.
But nothing like brought that stuff together. And I think that market is still waiting for that innovation just to make it to even have the data there, right? Is there even enough metadata out there to do good AR or good VR? Right? Do we understand VR interaction well enough to make a good user experience? I think we're getting there, but I don't know.
Well, when I think of VR too, you know, Phosphor is fairly early in the cycle when Brookhaven came out, right? And that was pretty intense at times, and you know, just the experience of turning around this crazy ass monster in your face and you have to shoot it and stuff, and the way they kind of set the mood and everything.
That was a great experience that like it went viral, right? Because you saw people playing it and you saw their reaction and you wanted to see what they saw. That was a game that it's like, look at me having fun. Don't you wish you knew what I was doing? And then you put on the headset and
what am I looking at? Yeah. People were like curious, like what's going on in that headset? I want to be part of it.
Yeah. Like playing the game looked interesting. You wanted to try it because, you know, if your friend is like flinching and flailing around, you're like, why are they doing that? And then you put it on and you start flinching and flailing around because that's the natural thing to do when a monster is attacking you.
Yeah. In terms of VR, it's like, I've been saying for a while, like, is the Quest going to be one of those things that kind of breaks down that wall because you don't need the $3,000 computer, because you don't need cameras set up? You know, it is a much lower barrier of entry. It's a lower cost also. And, you know, to some degree, it's done well, because I remember looking at them in December and reading they were, you know, sold out until like mid-February. So, you know, whether that was strictly on the planning side that they dropped the ball or it just sold that many units. But, and I'd also seen something over the weekend that was interesting, that was just talking about people, while they get excited when they see people reacting to VR, people are also very self-conscious, you know, when you're wearing VR, because, you know, you're vulnerable, right? Like somebody could whatever be laughing at you or making a face or, you know, some weird hand gesture or something. So somebody was just saying, you know, they feel like almost like they're naked when they have the headset on because they feel so exposed because they don't know what's going on around their environment. You know, that's something to get over too, right? So how can you do it in a way people don't feel vulnerable beyond just somebody in their basement playing it and make it more of a location-based or something like that? And, you know, without having to get into names, if you're not comfortable, I know you've worked on some location-based VR stuff too, right?
Yeah. A game that I was working on previously, it's been released in LB arcades. It's Predator VR.
Oh, that's a great brand.
Oh my God. I love it. I'm so fortunate to be able to work on it. It's a brand, you know, from childhood that I just loved. And, you know, we tried to sneak in as many little get to the chopper references as possible.
No, that's cool. So it's out right now at some location-based VR places. Is it US or international?
I believe international.
Okay.
You know, that was interesting, right? Because it's the Predator moves a lot. Like he's almost like a space monster. So kind of balancing this thing that can leap from tree to tree, has magic vision and can, eviscerate people with its claws versus, you know, a squad of some, you know, macho Marines.
Right.
That was a great, challenge to do. So we kind of did this asymmetric multiplayer thing where, you know, you could be three humans against one Predator. You can try to team up. You're trying to turn on these radio beacons. You're moving through the level. And the Predator can just kind of stalk you and toys with you, can go in for a kill. It was a really fun experience. And I'm really proud of, like, you know, what we did as a team with it, and that we got it out there.
Cool. And I think you said there's videos, YouTube videos for it.
Yeah, I know there's one playthrough of one of the levels on YouTube from a LB operator. And it's, yeah, it's something that there's a Steam page for it, but it's only for like Steam Cafe VR operators.
Oh, okay. So the funny or odd story from working in the industry question, I'm sure you don't have any. people are always like, which one do you want and what am I legally safe to say? But what are your thoughts?
All right, like, so
funny or odd story?
I want to say two, if that's okay.
Sure.
And one is relates to you. I remember when I was finishing up my time in QA at Midway, I was like, I want to do something else. I want to move past QA because, I had this art stuff, and you were one of the people I talked to, because John, you were such a great producer that I was like, maybe production is, the path that I want to take. And you were so awesome. You I think you printed out this Gamasutra article about like what production does. Like,
right.
This guy is so awesome, but I do not want to do production. Like reading this, this is crazy. Right. But so that's one of my, like, again, you are awesome, dude. And my other funny story is, so in Chicago, we had a developer named Spooky Cool. It was a great, they got bought up by Zynga. Now they're Zynga Chicago, very successful. They make, social slot types of games.
Hit It Rich. Yeah. I spent some time working there. Yeah. It's a good group of people there.
But when I started there, it was, they didn't even have an office yet. It was a remote work. It was awesome. We were making a mobile game on Facebook that was a city builder.
Mm-hmm.
It was that around that social game boom time where, consoles were ridiculously expensive and the economy collapsed and, what's next? What's the next big thing? And this was the next big thing, right? Social games.
Mm.
And I was excited. I'm working on it. I'm doing this bonus content. I'm doing missions for it. It's great. And I'm thinking like, oh, I wonder what the future holds. This is going to be fantastic. I can't wait to, And there's these arcade, legends working there. I'm like, oh my God, what are we going to do?
Brian Eddy and people like that. And Joe Kamikawa, who's a legend. Yeah.
So, we eventually find an office and we move in, and the writing was literally on the wall. Slots coming next year. I'm like, oh boy, I don't know anything about slots. I hope I can survive this. And it got to a point where, again, great group of people, but for me, that wasn't the right fit. I had no idea on, how slots worked at that time. I've developed an appreciation since then, because dude, it is an awesome way to design things. Just designing things for that anticipation reel is truly amazing. But at that time, I was like, I want to get back into Unreal. I want to do something, hands-on and something more video gamey. So I was like, oh, okay, writing's on the wall. This is not going where I thought it was going.
It sounded like it was cool. And it just...
That market changed. I mean, I remember the GDC Online that we went to that year. There was that shift. There was an exodus from Facebook to mobile.
Yeah.
I mean, just kind of every... Like Zynga was suffering. We were watching... CNBC in the conference room with, the Zynga CEO, kind of telling people why Farmville 2 or, Mafia Wars 2 was underperforming. It was just a lot of Facebook games were just taking a hit around that time.
Right. Yeah. It was changing, right? In the heyday, Zynga was making Hand Over Fist.
Oh, they were brilliant. Yeah. They basically had the ultimate friends list, and they just put a game on top of it.
What about a game now that you're playing or you're excited
John,
about?
The only game I have time to play right now is maybe like a few minutes of Fortnite here and there.
Right.
And I love it. It's not the same game, right? That like I started playing when they first kind of released. Like again, Switch and Fortnite's kind of my thing. I'll go in there, thank the bus driver, drop somewhere and try to remember like, how do I build something? It's like, oh, cool. Let me do this. Find some cool stuff. Like you said, find a fishing rod, go fishing somewhere, but just kind of explore and see what's going on. Mm-hmm. And it's good to just kind of play this bigger giant multiplayer game where you're just trying to survive, but it's so easy to just like drop out, drop in. You're not really worried about it. It's just a very casual, fun experience. Besides that, I've been playing way too much Zelda. The older one, on the Switch too. And that's been such a crazy update to the classic formula where, it's it's almost a survival game in its own, and the amount of exploration and scale is just insane.
Mm-hmm. To your point too, that is one of the cool things about the Switch where you don't have to have 3 hours and the big TV in the family room to monopolize and all that kind of stuff to play it, you can have a shorter experience. You can be around family and, you know, you've got small kids, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You've got demands with your time and stuff like that. So it's not like daddy's going in the room for 4 hours and you'll see me when it's 1 a.m.
No, there's none of that. You
know, it just doesn't fit your lifestyle, right? So I think a lot of people are in that same situation. So it's cool to have that platform, to have those kind of games and those experiences.
Another winner in the household is the Mario Brothers. My kid calls it Mario Jump Game. So we play a lot of Mario Jump Game multiplayer.
Yeah.
And then Mario Kart, which they call Mario Race Car. So
is there anything I should have asked you about but didn't?
You were going to ask me about my nickname. That was one of the things.
David Turkowitz became Turk. And I've known you for so long as Turk, I had forgotten your first name. So
I think this was like one of those first few weeks in QA. So this happened at the very start of like my journey through the game industry. I get there and there was another David there. And they're like, nope, we're not going to call you Dave. We have one of those. You're Turk. And I'm like, okay, I'm Turk.
who was it? JJ gave you the nickname?
No, that was Reggie. Knows? Reggie Banks.
Reggie. Okay.
Awesome. Reggie awesome tester. Yeah.
So where can people find you online? Like website, Twitter, things like
I'm
that?
I'm on Twitter at Turknical, T-U-R-K-I-C-H-N-A-L.
Okay.
I can write it I'll easier than I can notes. Spell it out loud. One of the things I love on Twitter, I follow so many people that do like VFX, that do, again, like scary pictures, that do game prototypes. Posting a GIF of your work in progress that can potentially go viral can go a long way. Just share your stuff with people. It's very easy to not want to share or feel like what you're doing isn't good enough. You need to get over that, right? Like people just have to put their stuff out there and, people will either like it or they won't, but most likely they'll like it.
Yeah. And you're right. Put it out there and see if people respond and use a couple of hashtags and, don't go crazy with it, but, start building a name for yourself. And, every couple of weeks, literally, like I'll have somebody like, hey, I've been interacting with this person on Twitter and, they're doing graphics and ray tracing and shaders and stuff. They're interested in what we're doing. We should reach out to them. So like, people get discovered or build rapport that then turn into jobs based on, what cool stuff that they post on Twitter and then how they interact with people that interact with what they've posted. So I also agree that people need to just get over their phobias, put stuff out there, get feedback, put more stuff out there, see if something sticks with people, build a name for yourself and have cool stuff to show. Discord's another option too. Do you mess around with that at all?
I do. I'm on a couple Discords. There's like some Phosphor people Discord. There's bigger kind of some indie game Discords that I found. Unreal. There's like an unofficial Unreal Slackers Discord. It's been really good just to see what people are talking about or problems people are running into. Or
our art director at Level X started I think it's called Great Lakes Art something, but he started a big group. It's kind of grown on Discord, and another option I think about it, and maybe it hasn't translated so much in indie community, but there's also Slack, right? There are groups out there on Slack where people talk about different topics and different things. So, that's another avenue for people to explore and get inspiration.
And I would say, focus on what kind of catches you, right? Because if you're doing something that you like, and especially in your spare time, it's going to be easy relatively for you, right? So if somebody's great at doing a post process, post your awesome post processes. If you're, if you like doing animation, post your awesome animation. If you like creating Gibbs and blowing dudes up, hey, in Chicago, there's your Level EX that's doing, kind of medical stuff. There's NetherRealm that's doing gross, stuff. There's, there's a niche for
options. Right. Yeah, definitely. There's all kinds of niches within niches. Turk, thank you for being on the show. I enjoyed it. Learned some cool stuff. Hope you had a good time.
John, it was my pleasure. It was a great time. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. If you found it interesting or helpful, please leave a 5-star review. I'd really appreciate it. And don't forget to subscribe. I have a lot of great episodes coming out. As always, I want to hear from you, the game development community. So give me a call at 224-484-4444. 7733 or reach out on the website gamedevadvice.com. Thanks and take care.